If everyone can take their seat. Mr. Vice Chair. All right, it is 6:32. We're going to call this meeting of the Opioid Settlement Task Force to order. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Esri.
Here.
Farney. Pugh.
Present.
Rodriguez.
Here.
Sexton.
Here.
Store.
Present.
Locke.
Here.
All right, we have a quorum. Can I have a motion for approval of the agenda? Mr. Sexton, second. Ms. Rodriguez, any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. I am looking for a motion to approve the minutes from the November 13th, 2024. Mr. Esri, second, going once. Ms. Rodriguez, any discussion? All right. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. I see no members of the public outside of people that we have invited. Would anybody like to speak in public participation? All right, we'll move along. Are there communications from the board? I have a few. I know, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, I just want to put into perspective what our peers, both in Illinois and around the county, might be doing with some of their opioid settlement money. So in Peoria County, they have, among other things, bought an app for their drug court where every client in drug court, not just opioid-affected individuals, will have access to this app to help them with their drug court needs and help them navigate drug court and serve the system. So that is a very helpful thing. In the state of Florida, Governor DeSantis used over $50 million of opioid settlement money to fund opposition to a ballot measure to legalize cannabis because it's a gateway drug to opioids. So I just wanted to give us some perspective on what other places are doing to help us use our own personal judgment as elected officials when making these decisions and when interpreting our very cautious legal advice that we may have received in the past. And before I go away from this, I'm just seeing if I have any others that I wanted to read to everybody, because there's a lot, and they're fun. McLean County is going to put some towards an opioid prevention officer with Chestnut. So they are helping fund employment at Chestnut, and Chestnut is similar to our Rosecrans. So very similar in what they're doing, similar to what we've done and had also gotten pushback on. And with that, any further communications from the board? No? Great. Let's move along. New business, contract with CU at Home for dedicated beds for opioid-impacted individuals. Do we have, I know Cedar is here. It was Cedar's understanding that Melissa would be zooming in. Do we have that set up? Or?
Yeah, I emailed her and said that,
sorry, with the mic.
That was my misinformation. I did just email her at the start of this meeting, letting her know that the audio would be posted tomorrow, but she would not be able to join that way.
Okay.
I don't think the idea was that they were going to present necessarily.
That is great. Then, Kate, if I could move you to the hot seat just in case there's any questions.
Absolutely.
This has been primarily the tweaks to address concerns of the state's attorney's office and the board have been handily handled by you. So you'd be the person on the hot seat for us, if that's okay. Once you're settled, I'll pepper you. I will note that the largest change you'll notice in the agreement from what we've previously approved unanimously, both in this task force and as a board, is that on page 5, it's in section 2, or Section 3C, CU at Home will designate 10 beds in the facility for the county contribution, or of our county contribution, is used exclusively for county-engaged individuals impacted by opioids. So that's 10 rooms that are dedicated to just our people who must be opioid impacted. And that is the requirement as set forth by the opioid impacted is the requirement set forth by the settlement. Our requirement is that our $580,000 would work out to those 10 rooms. In terms of the cost of the renovation, the cost to CU at Home, that is more than a proportional share for us to receive 10 rooms dedicated. And now that you're settled, Kate, could you kind of make sure the mic's on so that it can be picked up for the minutes later? Could you just give us an overview of the changes that have been made other than that?
Yes. So one of the things that CU at Home brought up in our discussion was the definition of opioid impacted. And at this time, there is not really an explicit definition of opioid impacted. The and that's federally and at the state level. The definition is really kind of dictated by approved uses that are listed on attachment C. And it really goes through several different kinds of approved uses. Some of what Chair Locke was talking about, other states doing. And we outlined a lot of those specific uses in our agreement.
Kate, do you mean attachment D, where it says approved uses of opioid settlement funds?
Yes.
Okay.
Did I misspeak?
So that's
Sorry.
That's page 21 in our packet.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'll let you continue.
So we referred to the approved uses that are going to be covered in this agreement, specifically in the agreement, to kind of help be able to define that for CU at Home. In Section 3, Part D, we identified Champaign County Drug Court and Champaign County Probation Services, the Pope Jail, and that will be the prioritization of Champaign County folks who will be in this facility. And in D, we outlined that the beds should not be filled by anyone who doesn't meet the criteria in attachment C and D.
So to put a very fine point on it, if for whatever reason there's not somebody who's involved with drug court, there's not somebody who needs a safe place straight out of the Pope Jail, if there's not somebody from probation with opioid that's opioid impacted at that time, that room should be vacant, correct?
Correct.
And Cedar, can I actually have you come on up to the microphone? I feel like you, I remember what you spoke about at the last meeting, so you'll be able to tell us.
Sure.
It was your estimate at the last time we spoke, at the last meeting that with this definition of opioid impacted, where it's basically where opioids have touched the person either as a user or as, you know, maybe they're homeless because mm-hmm. their partner has lost the house to opioid use. It was your estimation that approximately what percentage of your clients might that be?
So our current caseload, we have 27 clients currently, and we identified 11 that were opioid impacted currently. So it's over the one-third mark of our current client caseload.
Okay. And I guess not to belabor the point, but the reason that we came to this number of 10 and the requirement for it was due to concerns that were expressed by Ms. Reitz at our last meeting that the money has to go to opioid-impacted individuals, and we have to make sure we set it aside. And so in some horse wrangling and negotiations, we reached this number where it was acceptable to see you at home, and it proportionately about the share of what our money would be going towards, correct?
Yeah, it's proportionally, it would be very similar to what we have currently. I would imagine with the 10 extra beds, our overall, because we would still have the capacity in the other facilities, I would imagine overall our roster of opioid-impacted people, if we kept it at the current level, would probably go up to 16 or 17, you know, based on historical trends.
Okay. Are there any questions, Ms. Rodriguez?
I'm not sure if you I was not at the last meeting. Could you talk about your intake process and how you would screen for opioid-related issues and impacts?
Okay, so that's a very good question. So we currently have a vulnerability assessment, and I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty familiar with it. We designed it so it would give priority to people who were sentenced to drug court, would give priority to opioid users, and would also give priority to IV users. But recognizing that a person can maybe use a different substance other than opioids and still be an IV user. We also give priority to things like people who are marginalized demographics, and we also give priority to people who have been raised in foster care, and are also giving priority to people who are fleeing domestic violence. So I would say, quite honestly, if there's a demographic of people that are not directly have not directly used opioids either in street form or in a prescription medication form, it could possibly be the people that are fleeing domestic violence. And so historically we've seen a lot of people who are fleeing domestic violence, both women and LGBTQ people who are in partnerships with people who were using opioids. So that, we give priority to a high level to vulnerability. And like I said, I don't have the matrix in front of me, but we give priority to those people. And we also assign some points for motivation as well, too. And so those are, for instance, if a person is willing to undergo medically assisted therapy, they'll get an edge in the intake process because we think they'll probably have better outcomes than maybe a person who's unwilling to do medically assisted therapy.
Okay, so is this like a conversation? Is this an appointment that's been made? Like, how is the intake conversation happening?
So so we have a screening, we have an intake screening, and then we have a matrix that we design basically because of our capacity. We tend to have for every opening 3 or 4 candidates, and so one of the things we wanted to do is the two things we identified that are See You at Home's wheelhouse are people who have a high level of vulnerability and also people who have a high level of motivation. And so so one of the things we wanted to do was to identify those people and give them an opportunity to basically assess them according to this intake matrix. And then we would give the people that scored the best on the intake matrix, we would take into the program.
Interesting. One final question. Sorry to go on here. In the intake process, because these are really sensitive questions I notice. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm wondering how candid guests are whenever you're going through this intake process. Is that, I mean, so for example, I would imagine if you're going through a questionnaire or a matrix, I would probably play down my relationship to drugs to make me a more a candidate that would fit, I guess. Is that, or do you find that, or that's just my inclination of how it would go? Is that what you find?
Sometimes that happens. Where that's not typically what happens, though, and part of the reason why it's not what typically happens is we get referrals from Rosecrans and also Drug Court, and so people in those positions tend to be more honest about their substance use than others. Where we might potentially run into that particular issue might be we get quite a few referrals also from Strides. And so sometimes people who they might have a motivation to maybe minimize their substance use type of thing. But typically what happens is if they do minimize their substance use, we usually discover it pretty quickly. You know, just when they're in our program, they start exhibiting some behaviors associated with substance use.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Storr, did you have comments?
Sure. I'd like to see all of the beds used and occupied regardless. And I hope that, you know, the broadest possible interpretation of opioid use, past or present, or affected, could be applied so that take advantage of the opportunity to help these folks. Because I mean, it's not great. It'd be great if we had empty beds because, but if we have empty beds because, I'm sorry, you're not in the right, just the right slot, but you missed it by that much, I'd feel disappointed.
Well, there's a number of scenarios that we think are out there that we haven't even thought of yet. Like for instance, I know some people may have a chronic pain issue, and because they're homeless or experiencing homelessness, they may not be able to get proper medical care for it, and so so maybe it requires some rehabilitation, or maybe it's just a place to rest and recuperate, which is completely impossible on the streets. And so so it could be quite in order to cope with the pain, they may be either using opiates or be prescribed opiates to cope with their pain. So I think that's potentially another, I would say, medically vulnerable population that maybe we don't associate with traditional opioid use.
Mr. Pugh?
Thanks. Going off of Chris's question, though, but do you really expect these 10 beds, I think it was for, what, 10 years, roughly? Do you actually expect them, at least in the short term, to be not utilized at all for like any like considerable amount of time?
No, actually, I don't. I think we're probably going to fill them pretty quickly.
And keep it that way for years, yeah.
Yeah, based on our experiences with our current model of program, I would say those beds are going to get filled pretty quickly. And I would say we're going to be close to full capacity on those 10 beds. I would say the more likely scenario is we'll probably have more than 10.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep, thanks.
Mr. Esri?
Yeah, just a couple questions, I guess. The first one, and this is just out of curiosity, because I'm in favor of this no matter what, but has the state's attorney commented on this? I mean, I didn't.
The state's attorney, and Kate, jump in and correct me if I misstate any of this. The state's attorney's office, not the highest up, but within the state's attorney's office, let us know in reviewing. They reviewed the contract and they said, looks good, but we can't sign off on it. But those of us who were at this meeting and anybody who's listened to the recording of the previous meeting, specifically the many, the points that Ms. Reitz brought up of for how long? 10 years. How many beds? 10. And honestly, when we started negotiations, I thought we'd get 6. So thank you for 10. What happens if it's all provided for in there? Our attorney is giving us very cautious advice, and that's great in many ways. It is also just advice. I am not the board's lawyer. I went to law school. I passed the bar in 4 states, but I'm not the board's lawyer. I'm not licensed to practice law at any point. So what I'm saying is not legal advice. But in my contract law case, way back in the Stone Ages, there is a case where you learn about ambiguity. So if there is a term and it's not specified, like if opioid impacted is there, but it doesn't define opioid impacted, then reasonableness defines that term. In the absence of a specific definition, reasonableness. So our state's attorney's office wouldn't sign off on it because we created a definition for what opioid impacted means to make the contract work. But we couldn't force the legislature and force the court that decided the settlement to do that. So we couldn't do that. So we've considered our attorney's advice, and vote your conscience if you want to vote against or for, vote your conscience on it. But they couldn't sign off on it. Very cautious advice. But also keeping in mind what other counties and other states are doing with their money. Marijuana is a gateway drug. So, all drug court gets access to this app. We are saying these people touched by opioids get used to it. So that's a very long answer to say they didn't say yes, but they didn't say no.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that response. Thank you. And as I appreciate you bringing up during the comments just a few of other examples of what's been done with the money. I do appreciate the state's attorney's office, advising us and wanting to make sure it's done right and to not – the big thing, I believe, is to jeopardize future settlements that we might – that are coming down the road to where we would be deemed not worthy, I guess you could say, of receiving
– It's a potential.
Yeah, potential settlements further on down the road. But again, I have no problem with this. I haven't had a problem with it from the beginning. I do appreciate my colleague, Mr. Storr's comments about, ideally keep the beds, full as can be. Like you say, as far as I'm concerned, I agree with you completely. Yeah, the liberal, get as many in there. I mean, why have a bed if it's not going to be used? It is a big chunk of money, but again, it's not doing us any good sitting in a bank account drawing little to nothing in terms of interest. And if this can do some good, I believe it can. It's all for it. I'm all for it. And I appreciate seeing you at home working with us and bearing with us. The idea, initially, we would have already had this money in your hands. And that in and of itself is another reason why I'm for this. See You at Home has worked around it to acquire the property and all this. Well, their other funding I know came through, too, to truly acquire the property. But when we set out and initially pledged this money and then – to just kind of put it this way, that we kind of pulled it back, kind of like, oops, nope, it's not yours, at least not yet. Well, that doesn't sit quite right with me. So to finally get this money into the CU at Home's hands, where from, and again, this is my opinion, obviously, not speaking for anybody else, but to get it into CU at Home's hands where it can finally go towards getting this building ready for accepting and helping people who have been impacted by opioids and the such, it's a good thing. So I appreciate, Cedar, you coming here tonight and previous meetings and stuff as well. And thank you, Kate, for the work you've done on this. And I'll just go ahead and thank Chair Locke. I know she's done a fair amount of work, too.
I'll take the angry phone calls, too. Any other? Ms. Rodriguez?
Real briefly. I agree with everything that you said, Mr. Esri, especially the fact that it doesn't do us any good to have it sitting in a bank account. Is it not the case, if empty beds become an issue with this particular area, could they not return and we review the language again?
I would be willing. Unless there's any further comments from the board, I would entertain a motion to approve the contract with CU at Home. Dr. Storrs, so moved. Second, Mr. Sexton. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have a funding request for harm reduction program with CUPHD. I'd invite CUPHD to come forward. Mr. Trotter, just make sure that mic is red. Red means go here. You just introduce yourself and give us a brief overview of what your request is. I know it's in the packet, but for anybody who might be listening.
Sure. My name is Joe Trotter. I'm the Harm Reduction Program Coordinator at Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. I've been working in harm reduction here in Champaign County for almost 18 years. My program specializes in providing services to people that are currently using drugs to help them practice safer drug use techniques, to help them lower their harms, lower their risks. We provide them with materials as the primary thing, as well as education and then referrals into the system. Basically, we kind of serve as an initial kind of entryway into the medical system for a population that doesn't have a great track record or trust with the medical system. So the specifics of what we're asking for are the big challenge that we have right now is we don't have we have partial funding for the amount of syringes that we need on a yearly basis. We get some grant funding from Illinois Department of Public Health, but it's not enough right now to cover our current amount of need.
So specifically, how much money are you asking for, and would it all be going just to cover the cost of syringes for this existing program?
Yeah, the initial proposal that I sent through Kate, at least looking at some of the gaps that I saw in our funding, was about $12,000 that would be used only for the purchase of syringes. Of the syringes that we give out a lot. 2023, we gave out 300,000 syringes, which is the most we've ever given out. That does include clients that are not in Champaign County. So I ran some numbers on that. And on average, each year, it's somewhere between 75 to upper 90% of our clients are located within Champaign County. So a good chunk of it is for clients in Champaign County.
And the $12,000 of, I just wanted to make sure. I was like, did I interrupt somebody? I'm running this meeting badly. Just wanted to be clear. The $12,000 wouldn't buy 100% of your syringes. It
Correct.
Would buy a portion.
Right.
And 75 to 90% get used in Champaign County.
Yeah, that's my initial kind of estimate. Yeah.
All right. Now, Dr. Storrs.
Do the clients or the users come from surrounding counties where they are unable to get syringes? Is that it?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a lot of clients that come. A good chunk of the majority of them come from Vermilion County, the ones that are out of county, but we even get people that come from out of state, particularly Indiana, because of our close border there. So we have a lot of people that come from over there. There's not a lot of syringe service programs in the U.S., but in Illinois, there's not enough to meet the demand. So, yeah, we do get a lot of clients from other counties.
Ms. Rodriguez.
Hey again, Jill.
Hi.
How did you arrive at the estimate for 12,000?
So the initial estimate that I did was based on the most we've ever given, which was 300,000 syringes. The cost for us to get that is about $27,000. And we currently have $15,000 that we get from Illinois Department of Public Health through a harm reduction grant that we use that for purchasing syringes. So the what was left over then was the 12,000.
If you were to expand the program, what would that look like? If we were to, could we accomplish that by giving you more money here?
Sure. So it's not just the syringes that we have to buy. There's a lot of supplies that we get. Some estimates that I brought up, and this is a really rough estimate, but again, going with our largest year ever, if we got every client all the supplies they needed to make sure that one syringe and everything else required for it, the total price for that is about 50 cents per individual needle, which then comes down to about $147,000 to buy all the supplies that we would need for all 300,000 clients for the whole year. So again, that's a real kind of rough number, but the supplies are the biggest part, but the syringes are the biggest hurdle because we can't use federal dollars for the purchase of syringes. And a lot of our grant funding is through federal dollars.
It seems like the most immediate need is for these syringes, and I'm sure we can pass that tonight. But I'd be very interested to hear additional things that you would like funded.
Mr. Pugh?
Thank you. Per person, how many syringes do they usually get?
That varies. So we do a model that is take whatever you're comfortable carrying. So sometimes people take a few thousand a time. Sometimes people come in and just get one. So we really base our model just on what they are comfortable carrying today and just what their need is for that day. So, yeah, it really kind of varies.
Okay. And I think you told me this, too, how much money we have in the bank after what we just approved, about $500,000 roughly-ish.
Roughly a half a million. And there's about $90,000 a year will be coming in for the next 14.
Okay. So 90, I think you said about 47 or 45 to me. So it's 90 then. Okay. Good enough. I just want to know long term we're going to be funding this, make sure we have the money to keep it going. Yes.
I mean, it feels silly to do it like on the back of a napkin and be like, here you go. But yeah, please give us more options to fund.
Yeah, for sure. I did. My colleague that's with me also spoke with the Champaign County coroner, and she has a need for some like diagnostic testing that's really useful in analyzing an overdose death to run like toxicology for it. It's really, really expensive to do that type of testing. And there's a specific kind of testing device that she is looking into. And I'd be happy to provide more details. And I can send that along.
Please do. Okay. And please make sure to send her our way with that request, because I've heard it through the grapevine, but we've not yet heard from her.
Yeah.
Mr. Pugh.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. Just with two of them, the last thing, which I did try to listen to a few times with the audio. I think it may be broken in a few different places. But yeah, with what Julia said, too, with, you know, how far off the trail can we go and still have it considered opioid? That's my only concern. It doesn't come back on us.
Mr. Essery.
Yes. Not quite sure how to question this, but out of curiosity, to just try and put some numbers to it in terms of cost for like a person who doesn't have clean needles and therefore has other health issues,
mm-hmm.
like the amount it would cost to the public, you could say, whatever, or just care for like a year compared to someone who's using clean needles like every, you know, all the time and
so
thus doesn't have the other health issues.
Yeah, so probably the biggest cost is if that client were to get hepatitis C. So hepatitis C is a virus that passes primarily through injection drug use. The cost of treating hepatitis C is about $80,000 for the medication for one individual, if their insurance will cover it. And so the best way to prevent the spread of HIV is giving clients enough syringes that they don't have to share that single syringe between multiple people. So the original concept around harm reduction is that you give people supplies for what they need and enough supplies to give to their friends that they might come in contact with also. There's a real classic case of a big outbreak of HIV in Indiana that they allowed a temporary lift of having syringe exchange available there because of the outbreak that they had. So to get to your question, basically hepatitis C and HIV are kind of the bigger ones that we need to make sure that the practice of using drugs doesn't include the sharing of the needle, and so that's part of what these supplies then would be going to.
That was a plenty good answer for what I was looking for. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Any other?
I guess could we round this up to $15,000? You think you could do more with $3,000 more?
Sure.
Okay, I would like to round that up to $15,000 if that's all right with everybody.
There is a motion to approve funding of $15,000 to CU PhD. Is there a second to that motion? Dr. Storr, any discussion? Okay. I guess first we'll vote on the motion to up it to $15,000. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Now back to any discussion on the funding request itself. Great. All in favor of funding $15,000 to CU PhD's harm reduction program, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. There we go. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Please tell your friends. All right, that brings us to next steps. Since we've met last, I had a beginning meeting with Lynn Canfield about how we could possibly incorporate the Mental Health Board into this so that we, as the non-experts, are not the arbiter of how to hand out this money. We're wonderful, and we love to give it away. However, there are experts, and there's a process and how to, you know, seek it out from the community, how to vet the requests, all the things that, you know, if we unlimited time, unlimited opportunity, I'm sure that we are all able to do that. But we've been in the process of discussing this with Lynn. She would like the ultimate decision to be up to us, but potentially, like, they could amass the requests and vet the requests, and then it would come to the board. If anybody's in favor of that continuing, we'll keep that conversation going. It's nice to hear, because I have heard through the grapevine that our new coroner was going to be seeking this. We haven't gotten the request yet. Has anybody else heard anything through the grapevine or have any ideas of how we should be spending our remaining money, Dr. Storr?
Well, I've been on this task force since the beginning, and so we heard a number of requests very early on. One was to help support medically assisted treatment in the jail, and through the drug court, Judge Ben Dwyer came and spoke that. So, if you think it sounds like kind of going back and asking some of these folks to please kind of write the stuff up and send it through the Lynn Canfield Mental Health Board.
As to Drug Court, there's an ample grant right now that we can't even spend all of the money, as we have not started a mental health court, and that grant was to cover both. So as of right now, there's no request from them. And as to the jail, they've not said no forever, but they have said no right now. Captain Vogus is particularly worried about a clean handoff if we would start someone on medication-assisted treatment, and then them not have somewhere to go. See you at home, having these beds available will be a much easier, more direct pipeline. There's also the issue of the jail now isn't what the jail 4 years ago was. Pre-Safety Act, people came in and out of the jail with some regularity. It's a different reality now where people in the jail awaiting trial are either going to be going out into the community after they're exonerated or going to prison after they're convicted. It's no one's being held and getting sentenced to county time. Only the most serious charges are being held at this point. So it's not as easy to have that jail to community pipeline in place. But I will note the DOC does provide Vivitrol to people if they want it when they're getting released. So it sure would be nice if we could emulate the enlightened Department of Corrections. But yeah, we reaching out, anyone on the task force is welcome to please reach out. Ms. Rodriguez.
I can't remember what meeting that this was on, but the Greater AIDS Community Project, I think that's their name. Yes. I suggested that they begin to maybe look into funds for this, in particular, obviously, with opioid impacts. But I know she might be reaching out to you, Daria, and her last name is a tough one, but her name's Daria.
Until we have the full workup or the full system in place with mental health board, the process will still be to reach out to Michelle and or Kate, and then it goes from there. But if there's somebody looking right now, Michelle and Kate are your women. Mr. Pugh, did you have?
Yes, thanks. Probably in the next few months, if nobody minds, I'm going to be reaching out to the different veterans groups, the VFW post, the Legion post, stuff like that, to see if there's a need there in those communities. Because a lot of the times that might be the one organization that they'll actually reach out to for help and nothing else. So I believe I'm going to go into them, the countywide post commanders meeting sometime here in the next week or two, and I'll try to get some information back from them, see what they say.
That's an excellent idea. Let us know if you need anyone or you want anyone to tag along with you for any of that, but that's an excellent idea. Thank you. All right. We don't have a date of the next meeting. I think we need to get get the plan in place with Mental Health Board or get proposals in front of us. So we will not set a date of the next meeting at this point. I have no chair's report. I will call this meeting adjourned at 7:15 p.m. Thank you, everyone.